We are going to start this episode of the OHL podcast with everybody's favorite four words. Are you ready? I told you so. Dan Mahar, did we not? You can listen back, what, 2, 3 weeks when the Ontario Hockey League, we talked about how they issued stiff but necessary suspensions in the Sudbury Bounty Gate. Then they walked them back, and we said then, at the time of the walk back, you painted yourself into a corner. You cannot possibly suspend any player on any team in this league during the regular season and carry that suspension over into the playoffs. And what did the Ontario Hockey League go and do? I'll turn it over to you, good sir. I told you so, or we told you so in this case.
Well, if there's one thing I've learned over the years, regardless of the regime, it's never trust the OHL to be consistent in the application of justice. And when people ask me, what do you think this guy's going to get or that guy's going to get? This is why my answer is usually, who knows? Because they never stick to a template. Sometimes they seem to get it right for a little while. They'll get two or three in a row that seem fair, seem right. Apply that template consistently. But then next thing will happen and who knows? It's out the window. So I don't even know what to say at this point, Farwell.
Well, I'll tell you a few things that I'd like to say about this. I find it particularly vexing in this case because, of course, it ended up involving a Kitchener Ranger. So the accusations of homerism are flying fast and free, and that's fine. Look, we understand that we're on a platform here, and that opens us up to criticism, but just go back and listen 2, 3 weeks ago when we talked about the walk back of those suspensions in Sudbury, where Nathan Villeneuve's suspension, first of all, Evan Kanyan's suspension got reduced, so he does make it in time for the playoffs, and then the bizarro world suspension of Nathan Villeneuve. It remains 15 games, but you carry 6 over to the next season, and he gets to play in every playoff game this year. So it turns out that Trent Swick, for an incident that we all agree, I'll bet you Trent Swick, if he was sitting here right now, would agree that he deserved to be suspended for what he did. He jumped Max Namestnikov of the Guelph Storm after Namestnikov ran Cameron Reed, the Rangers rookie defenseman, into the boards. No penalty on the play, but we've talked about this before, Dan, how we don't really love it, but it's the way the game works. You lay a big hit on me, I'm going to come back and punch you in the face. Namestnikov had no interest in any fisticuffs. Swick jumped him, got about 5 licks in with Namestnikov down on the ice before the officials got in, pulled him off, and it's a 5-game suspension. We could argue the length of the suspension. As you said before, if people ask you, what do you think this player is going to get? What do you think that player is going to get? Are they going to apply the template from the last time or not? This would be, I would argue, based on previous cases, on the harsh side, but I'm not even here to argue that. It doesn't matter. That becomes rather subjective. Black and white to me in this regard, after what you did in Sudbury, is you say, fine, Trent Swick gets 5 games, but he serves the 2 remaining regular season games, and then he comes back for the playoffs and serves the other 3 next season. That's the precedent this league set, and all of a sudden the precedent doesn't seem to apply. It makes no sense, but we warned the league when it walked back the Sudbury suspensions that this was the situation it put itself in. I'm positive, I even said at the time, I'm sure they're just holding their breath and hoping that there is not another suspendable offense. Well, guess what, Ontario Hockey League? You got it, and you done gummed it up.
And now they've opened themselves up to all these accusations, right? Whether you can accuse people of being homers or being biased all you want, but you open yourself up to these claims when you aren't consistent with how you apply it. So is there any sort of directive or template or language that explains an off-ice incident is lesser than an on-ice or this type of incident you can get back for playoff games, this one you can't? I've heard the threshold for being able to appeal is 10 games, yet the league went back and reviewed a suspension to Connor Federkow in Niagara and allowed him to play in his last game at home. So they make these overrulings and they change their minds sort of ad hoc, it seems, when they feel like it or when they don't. And I got to be honest, I know this is going to sound homerish as well, Farwell, but the biggest problem I have with Trent Swick piece is not, like you said, dumb on his part, overreaction, deserved the suspension. But there was an incident featuring the very same team earlier in the season with the roles reversed, and there was no penalty. A penalty, a 2-minute minor, I believe, in the game, no suspension. So the issue I have here, and people can twist themselves in all kind of knots to say these were different incidents, but they weren't. There was a hit. The player responded against an unwilling opponent, threw a bunch of punches. Refs pulled them apart. Almost identical incidents. The London player was Jackson Edward in this case, throwing punches on Adrian Misiljevic. No suspension. So my issue there is Trent Swick was in that game. Trent Swick saw that. Trent Swick says, "Oh, I guess that's not that serious." So later in the season, when he does it, so wait a minute, now it's a 5-game suspension. I'm not saying it justifies the actions. Clearly, they were wrong in both cases, but there's no way anyone's ever going to be able to convince me that there was a 0-game to 5-game difference in those two incidents. And when you're inconsistent in how you apply it, you're going to get all kinds of criticisms and fair ones, if I'm, in my opinion.
So it's interesting you bring up the Jackson Edward example. It happened 10 days before the Trent Swick incident. And you're right, it's remarkably similar. Difference being that it was Adrian Misiljevic that first hit Edward, so he's responding on the same player. So does that make it okay if Cameron Reed gets back up and wails on Max Namesnikov? I doubt it, but what's interesting here, and you can see both of these videos if you like, and you can judge for yourself. I've posted them on my Twitter at Farwell underscore OHL. What I've learned since is that the suspension to Swick was as well, was A, necessary and B, severe because he was assessed 5 minutes and a game misconduct on the play. But then it just begs the question, why was Jackson Edward assessed only a 2-minute penalty for roughing? It doesn't add up unless the threshold is the number of punches thrown. And again, you can watch the video for yourself. Edward gets in three. Swick gets in five before the official comes in and breaks it up. Both players, I would suspect, would have continued punching until a person in stripes got there. So it becomes rather arbitrary, and that's what gets really frustrating. And I'll say again something I've said a couple of times through the season this year. I thought the league had been doing a pretty good job. The response time seemed to be picking up a little bit. The consistency, you know, whether you liked it or not, at least seemed like, you know, whether you liked the application of the rules or not, seemed to be, you know, in the same ballpark most times. But boy, oh boy, they've really left themselves in a bad position as the playoffs begin. And don't forget, I'll just say this again so it's on the record. Heaven forbid, like, I hope Nathan Villeneuve has a long, successful playoff and, you know, doesn't, God forbid, injure another player. But if that happens, oh my goodness, I don't know how the league explains itself in that regard.
No, like we've said all along, they've opened themselves out up to every criticism they get, and they deserve it. Because you can't arbitrarily make these decisions, flip-flop on some and not others, use super gray loopholes like the one you just described. Well, it depended on what the call on the ice was. Well, the league's reviewing anyway. You either do want these incidents or you don't. And if the league's reviewing them, a defenseless player who wasn't willing to fight being jumped and punched is the same as it is every single time. And the Nathan Villeneuve case was a unique one in that it was related to comments made in a chat offline, etc. So maybe there's not the precedent there. However, why jump the gun and rule that this guy's getting 15 games if you're just going to change your mind as more opinions and evidence come to light? Do it right the first time, get it right the first time, and have some sort of standard the league understands when playoff games will or will not count towards the suspension. Because I don't think anyone knows. And if the players don't know, how can they be held accountable for their actions to the same level that you're asking them to be? So I think the league has opened a can of worms here, like you said, Mike, with inconsistency, with lack of communication. And all I know is if I'm a lawyer in a court of law and I see my client had witnessed an incident, perpetrated an incident, and there were two extremely different punishments, I would be using that as my case.
I think it's a great point on Swick having been involved in the game where something very similar happened, and he watched one of his teammates on the receiving end of what he did to Max Namestnikov. I hadn't even thought of that aspect of it. But one of the other things that strikes me in all of this is that really it was an arguably inconsistent application of the rules that got the league in trouble in the first place when it comes to the Nathan Villeneuve suspension, because this, I think we could argue, and probably successfully, was connected to the Connor Lockhart suspension in Oshawa, right? There was a police investigation by Durham Regional Police. the league suspended Lockhart immediately, pending the results of the investigation. The investigation comes to its conclusion. There was no wrongdoing on the part of Connor Lockhart. He's already been out 8 games. The league announces the suspension was 8 games. He's eligible to return immediately. Okay. Well, the league knew about the bounty or the alleged bounty in Sudbury well before launching the investigation and did not suspend Nathan Villeneuve pending the results of the investigation. Didn't suspend him while the investigation was going on. Then they conclude the investigation. They arrive at a conclusion and issue their judgment. And all of a sudden, it's going to carry over into the playoffs. Had they started the investigation sooner, or had they applied the suspension pending the results of the investigation, Villeneuve never would have missed playoff games because this goes back to January. You could have suspended him probably for 20 games at that point, and he wouldn't have missed a playoff game. I'm sure that's the argument the appeals committee heard, and there you go again. So you had an inconsistent application of the rules, and it led the league. It snowballed from there. Simple as that.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. And it will snowball, and it'll continue to snowball every time you have knee-jerk reactions or inconsistent reactions. So it would behoove the league this offseason to sit down and talk these things through and come up with templates for the variety of incidents. Because when push comes to shove, there aren't that many different kinds of incidents, right? There's headshots, there's hitting from behind and vicious boarding, there's off-ice things related to social media and threats. There's arranged that it wouldn't take that long to workshop this out and say, here's generally the template for punishment. Repeat offender, it moves to X, et cetera. But you shouldn't be caught off guard by these things, Mike, especially in this day and age when you look at comments made in social media, these types of things. You should have an idea right off the hop what this is going to cost, and it should be communicated down the chain before the season starts. Because you can't have everyone being caught off guard with the punishments, either too light or too severe or just too inconsistent. And that's where we're at right now.
Well, that's going to tie into something else that we're about to talk about, and that is officiating in this league in general. Fans get pretty upset. Situations like this draw all kinds of criticism. I've heard the ref you suck chant in more rinks than I can count this year. And in fairness, I don't mind it. It's part of the good-natured fun of the game, if you will, but I can only imagine the added pressure that puts on the official on the ice. But just before we move on to that, one more thing I wanted to add to this is how frustrating it gets. And I think this is why the officials on the ice bear so much of the brunt of the criticism, because the commissioner of this league, albeit the outgoing commissioner, David Branch, insists that he has no idea why the Nathan Villeneuve suspension was modified in the manner that it's been modified. And that's something you'll have to ask the appeals committee. Well, first of all, I find it really difficult to believe that the commissioner of this league for 45 years, who has his fingers on virtually every aspect of the game, as far as I've ever understood, I have a really hard time believing he has no idea how the appeals committee arrived at the decision. But even if he didn't, how do we talk to the appeals committee then? Who's on the appeals committee and who's the spokesperson for the appeals committee? That leaves a lot of us in the dark. And if the media can't get those answers can't be communicated to the public, the fans, and those are the people that pays the money to see your hockey games.
Exactly. It's a great point. And I'm all for a few concepts. Obviously, transparency. So you being clear with why you do things and explaining them. And I'm also great with open-mindedness. I have no issue if someone makes a call and something else comes to light or sober second thought or through appeal, they decide to change their mind. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with in certain circumstances, someone reflecting and changing, but this has to be communicated as to why. What is the new information? What's the mitigating circumstance here? This stuff needs to be communicated down the chain. Otherwise, you have a bunch of people like you and I are sitting here right now, Mike, saying, what changed between the 15 game and the reduction, or the change, I suppose, to push the games into next year? So something the appeals committee heard, changed their mind, be transparent with it. I'm okay if it's a legitimate reason, but we're left guessing as to what that is.
I'm certain this won't be a universally popular take. So I'll just remind you right here. You can find me on Twitter at Farwell underscore OHL. You can send us an email anytime, OHL podcast at rogers.com. And look, if Dan becomes collateral damage, hey, he reads those emails too, or tweet them at Dan Mahar. I really feel bad. Here comes the take that will not be universally popular. I honestly, truly, I feel bad for the officials in this game. I really do. Because if we're confused by all of this, imagine how they feel when it comes to the application of the rules. You mentioned the Connor Fedorkow decision to allow him. And look, I've got nothing against Connor Fedorkow. I'm sure he's a lovely young man. He received an automatic suspension for exceeding the number or the threshold of boarding penalties taken in the season. Remember, Dan, we can back up, I don't remember how many episodes, when we learned that these thresholds even existed, right? For boarding, for checking from behind, for checking to the head. We always knew that thresholds existed for fighting. We tell me 10 years later, that's how long these thresholds have been on the books, and we've never heard them called before. So that's going back to your point about what changed. Why didn't we know about this? Surely to goodness, over 10 years, somebody exceeded these thresholds. But what happens in the Fedorkow case is the penalty was assessed on the ice, your penalty for boarding, you've exceeded the threshold, suspension's automatic. In order to rescind that suspension, which the league did, and you understand why, he's in his home community, friends and family are going to be there. Like I said, he's probably a lovely young man. You want him to be able to play in his last junior hockey game because the team he plays for, the Niagara Ice Dogs, are not going to the playoffs. I get it. I get it. But this is where you start introducing shades of gray. The rules are the rules. And what happens here then is the official on the ice makes the call. The league looks at the video and clearly decided it wasn't a boarding penalty. Either that, or they just said it doesn't count in this case because we want to play his final game. One way or the other. But what it sounds like to me is that the game is being re-refereed after the fact. And that, I'm here to tell you, is not fair to the men and women that wear the stripes in the Ontario Hockey League. It's just not fair.
100%, 100% agree. So I guess it sounds like there's a compassionate grounds clause here to allow Fedorkow to play that final game of his OHL career. So what it sounds like, is that unreasonable? Maybe not. But like you said, the rules are the rules, and the threshold is as black and white as it comes. So again, if I'm a kid sitting at home who sat out a game because I exceeded my threshold, all of a sudden I'm saying, hey, wait a minute. Like, what's going on here? You cost myself a game for the exact same action that this guy's now being allowed to play on. So what is it? Is there a compassionate grounds clause for those ending their careers? Communicate that then. But is that not a slippery slope then too? What if someone's in his last hurrah in the league and wants to go out with a bang? You get all kinds of considerations here, Mike. I just again, with anything, consistency, and you referenced the officials. I agree with you wholeheartedly. It puts them in a tough spot because when the league starts overruling what they've already called, you're saying, well, we don't think the officials got it right, or thanks for doing your job, but we're just going to step in here and do it for you after the fact. So now are you making the officials second guess what they call on the ice? Because, well, you know, the league overruled this last time, or the league added to that. It just becomes completely inconsistent. And if we ask the officials on ice for consistency game to game, is it not reasonable to ask the league to be consistent off ice in the same vein?
Bingo, when it comes to the indecision that might result for any referee now, knowing that it might be overruled upon review, right? And I love your description of compassionate grounds in the Fedorkow case, which, again, I get it, sure. But the minute you introduce one shade of gray, then how much further does it get extended the next time somebody says, well, this was for compassionate grounds? Does this qualify for compassionate grounds? Does that qualify for compassionate grounds? And all of a sudden, the ball of yarn gets that much more tangled up, and it's messy, messy, messy. The other thing that we've seen towards the end of this season, Dan, and it's an interesting one. It reminds me a little bit of Mouthguard Gate, if I can create that, from last season. Do you remember all of a sudden all of these players were getting these 10-minute misconducts for mouthguard violations? We counted dozens of them over a couple of weekends, and it seemed to come out of nowhere. So we had Rangers assistant coach Jeff Kerzakis suspended for 2 games for abuse of an official after he and Darcy Birchall, the referee, had words, and some of the words to Jeff Kerzakis said Darcy Birchall did not appreciate, and out of the game went Kerzakis. And what, 3 days later, it happens to Al Letang and his assistant in Sarnia? My guess would be either immediately following the Birchall Kerzakis incident or even leading into that weekend, the penultimate weekend of play in the Ontario Hockey League, there was some kind of memo sent out saying that X, Y, and Z will not be tolerated, and we're going to clamp down on it. Just like that in games 65 through 68. Or it was immediately brought out after the Birchall Kerzakis incident, and all of a sudden, Al Letang's getting, like, imagine, don't tell me that there has not been an expletive-filled interaction between a coach and a referee before game number 65 or 66. I'm sorry, but I have a difficult time believing that. And all of a sudden, you're going to start cracking down to this level that coaches are being kicked out of the game. And remember that what ended up happening then in Sarnia with both coaches being punted, they had to get general manager Dylan Cica to come down from the press box to get behind the bench. The league, for reasons I cannot explain, the league itself put out on its social media accounts that overager Kai Schwint was behind the bench for the Sarnia Sting. What kind of a look is that for the Ontario Hockey League? If you're trying to recruit the best players in the world to come to this league, you might want it to look a little less Mickey Mouse. I'll get down off my soapbox, but I couldn't believe that look from the league. But the other piece of it is, I don't know why you're waiting till game 65 or 66 to start saying now we're clamping down. Well, I would strongly encourage you, because the referees don't abuse, don't deserve abuse from coaches, from players, from fans. So have bring this up at the offseason Board of Governors meetings, put the memo out to, like, serve notice to all the teams. If it's a bumpy start for, to instill in people that you mean this, fine. But you don't bring it out in the second to last week of the season. You just don't do that.
No, and I don't know if it's a precursor to the playoffs when they know emotions are going to be high or what the case may be, but we all know from being around hockey our whole lives that the spectrum of officials has a complete spectrum of tolerances as well. You have officials that will tolerate an awful lot of verbal abuse, which they shouldn't have to, but they do. They're not thin-skinned. And then at the very other end of the spectrum, you have hair trigger officials who don't tolerate much. And it can change with the mood. It can change with their own emotion. Someone could say something that offends them. Then the rest of the game, that team is getting penalties, getting called on everything. So they're kind of taking it out on everyone and everything. So the common thread here is emotion, right? Emotions ramp up behind the bench. Emotions ramp up on the ice for the guys wearing stripes. The best ones in both cases are the ones that can kind of contain that a little, not cross the lines. So I don't know what the answer is, but changing the directive late in the season like this seems Mickey Mouse, as you put it. But you also have to, I mean, I always on this one, I always come down on the side of the officiating where I don't believe anyone in any job should have to take that kind of verbal abuse. But it also ties into the consistency piece as well, though, right, Mike? Like the league, the officials, everyone needs to seek consistency because when the emotions get high, and things get said tend to be directly tied to when the consistency isn't there, and it's clearly not there, right? So I think that all the league and the officials can do is seek consistency as much as they possibly can, and then coaches, it's on you to react accordingly and keep the mouths in check. But yeah, the last couple of weeks has just been Mickey Mouse, like you put it.
I think that we have to really dial down some of the emotion when it comes to these interactions between coaches and officials, players and officials, etc. If we take a step back, and I get it, like, this is highly competitive, right? It's big business, certainly at the major junior level. It's big enough business to I get it. And I would argue I'm as competitive as the next person, but we really do have to consider, if you think back in all of the bad calls, in all of the games, in all of the sports, I mean, how many times really is, let's say, a perfect game in baseball blown because of an egregiously bad call, right? How many times does the bad call directly impact the outcome of the game? like a handful, if that, and I'm talking over the entire spectrum, right? The entirety of all of the games played. So yes, it hurts in the moment. It's this, it's that. I would argue the better you control your emotions and just, okay, it happened. Let's move on and let's deal with it. The better off you're going to be. It's a little bit of adversity within the game. Oh, well, these things at the end of a season tend to have a way of working themselves out. You are the on the receiving end of as many bad calls as you are benefiting from calls that were bad against the other team, right? So easier said than done, I know. But unless you want the game to be officiated by robots, unless you want the game to be reviewed the next day and all of the penalties called and or changed then, kind of like the Federcow example, then I don't know what more you want. These are human beings. They are imperfect, but they are doing an incredibly difficult job. And I would say the more we can support them in doing that job, the better off we're all going to be. We talk all the time, Dan. Your point about consistency is great, but I think game management matters so much. That's really what the officials are out there, right? They're managers of the game. And if we put them in an environment where they feel safe, where they're comfortable, then I think they're going to manage the game a whole heck of a lot better. The Combine is coming back again this summer. I think that was a great initiative by the Ontario Hockey League. It's got to get the next generation of officials ready to be working at this level. And the more difficult we make it on them now, the more difficult it's going to be to find them for the future. So I would love to hear a discussion like that in the off season to figure out where we're at and how we might be able to improve. And it probably wouldn't hurt if we could add a layer or two of accountability so that we all understand better when somebody does have a bad night and we're all entitled to them. What does that look like? Are they, I don't know. Are they going to miss a week of assignments? Are they going to go back like a retaking your driver's test? Are they going to take some classes for the next week and miss their game? Something like that. I don't know what it looks like, but something so that we understand, look, this guy had an off night. We understand, and we're going to help him have fewer off nights in the future. Maybe.
Yeah, and there's league officiating supervisors that attend these games, and there's we don't know enough about that process though, right? Because I think officiating's no not any different than any other careers, the ones like you and I have or anyone out there, where there's constant career development. And I look for opportunities to make myself better at my job, and that should be available to everyone in any job, including the officials. The goal should be to help them get better. So no one's perfect. They're all human, especially this year. The OHL has a number of younger officials. They're learning the league. They're learning how to interact with these coaches and players. They need some experience to get there, and they need some help to get there. So I agree with you, Mike. There has to be some sort of mechanism, and it might partially exist now where after a game, they get that review and say, this is how I would have handled this differently, or, how did this interaction go with this coach? Here's how you might have managed that better. Help them get better at the job. And as fans, as viewers of this league, we also have to expect that they're not going to be perfect. But we like to see some, I'd love to have some communication transparency around that piece for the officials, how we help them improve, how what the accountability is for them when they have a really off night. We know how there's accountability for some of the players and obviously the coaches. So just share that with the league because we need to know that those mechanisms exist.
The point on the young officials is a good one too. I'm not sure we've still caught up to the change to the four-man, four-person crew, and the very best of the best in the Ontario Hockey League across the Canadian Hockey League really got taken up to the pros. And I think major junior hockey in Canada is still trying to catch up to that and making sure they've got the right balance. So we'll see where it goes. And this is one of the important things, Dan, when it comes, and I alluded to this with kind of cracking down at this point of the season to the point where you've got a player standing behind the bench, not a good look for the league when it comes to recruiting. And you pointed out to me earlier today when we were texting before the show that some top prospects, and I think the Ontario Hockey League should be paying close attention to this, but are considering a pipeline to the pros that is not the Canadian Hockey League, or in this case, specifically the Ontario Hockey League.
Well, it's always a tough decision for a 16-year-old hockey player, right? What's my path? Do I lean towards an NCAA option where I might get an education that I prefer? I might not get as many games in. It might take me a while to become a regular in that lineup. but I have more time to hit the weight room, do physically develop, all that kind of stuff. Or do I go the OHL, CHL route where I might have a quicker path to the pro game, lots of reps, pro type schedule, but it might not get those reps in the weight room, might not get access to the education you want because you're still too young to make that choice, but then you lose the NCAA option later. So it's a really daunting decision for these kids at this age. And of course, when you have to make that decision and there's a proverbial gun to your head, you might opt to say, well, I'm not going to go to the CHL just yet. I'm going to commit to the USHL or the BCHL or one of these other options that keeps my NCAA option open so I can have another year of accumulating information and data and seeing where I want to go. So that seems like a reasonable decision. It's really not good for the CHL and the OHL because you're losing some of your top homegrown talent to these other options, and that has to be a real concern for the league. And it's hard for them to rectify because they don't control NCAA policy, which says second you suit up for an OHL game, you're no longer eligible. That may change. There's discussions right now about that changing. A lot of balls in the air here, but the OHL to some degree here does not control its own fate, but they have to be extremely concerned, I think, about this trend as more and more league options open up for these kids that are actually viable now.
This follows reporting from Ken Campbell just today that the top four defense prospects for the Ontario Hockey League draft this year have already committed elsewhere, and others are looking at that, including Caleb Malhotra, yes, of that Malhotra family. And what's interesting, and you mentioned the BCHL, Dan, that's one of the leagues that Malhotra is considering. And what I find interesting about that, and I just wanted to add to this, is the British Columbia Hockey League has, junior hockey league that is, has removed itself from under the Hockey Canada banner, right? It's kind of going its own right now. And I'm hearing more and more rumblings that there's more of that to come in the not too distant future. Leagues that want to get out from under the Hockey Canada banner and kind of go their own way. So just don't be surprised if you hear about more of that in the not too distant future. It's really interesting times for Hockey Canada as an umbrella organization. All right, we have arrived at the most interesting time of the Ontario Hockey League season. That, of course, is playoff time. So naturally, we've got some playoff predictions for you on the OHL podcast this week. We will also revisit where it all began and how far off the mark we actually were, plus our prospects of the week. Oh, it's not as painful as you. No, it's going to be painful. We'll get all to all of it coming up on the OHL podcast. All right, Dan, where did it all begin? Let's start with the good. We were pretty good at identifying the teams that were not going to make the playoffs. We both had Peterborough and Niagara missing in the East. Although, do you remember early on the way Peterborough started? We're thinking, oh my gosh, like we're way off the mark here. But that turned out to be the right pick. And then you had Kitchener Sarnia missing in the West. I had Windsor Sarnia missing in the West. But we're picking nits at that point. We did pretty well on the teams that were not going to make it. On the other side of things, we both had Sudbury finishing tops in the East. And if you can believe it, they finished fifth. But it was interesting listening back to our Eastern analysis where we talked about all of these teams that were kind of bunched together and how were we possibly going to be able to figure out who finishes where. Kudos to you for recognizing Mississauga. You had them as one of your darker horses. They actually end up finishing with home ice advantage to open the playoffs. I called Oshawa a dark horse in the East, and that turned out to be a pretty good, bold prediction. And then over in the West, both of us liked Owen Sound a little more than we should have. And you liked the Sioux a little less than you should have. You had them down in the lower tier. I had them up higher. I think we both picked Guelph pretty close. You had them a little stronger than I did, but they were a tough team to figure out this year. And oh, I should also give you credit for Erie. You talked about them having pieces that you liked in the West, and in fact you picked exactly where they would finish, saying they would finish fifth. So there you go, some of the highlights and or lowlights from our predictions at the beginning of the season.
You're too kind, Mike. I'll throw myself under the bus and say I messed up badly on a couple teams in the West for sure. Sioux, I didn't think they were quite ready to arrive yet after a rebuild year. I thought they'd need another year. They didn't. Sorry, Sioux. Owen Sound, what are you doing to me? Your roster's better than it finished in the standings. I still contend. I may have been off on that one. I shouldn't have been off by 6 spots or whatever it ended up being. So, but I did kind of mess up the West. You nailed it on the teams missing, Mike. So I'll give you credit there.
Well, but we both had Owen Sound higher. We both had them third. We went SAG, London, Owen Sound. It goes London, SAG, Sioux. So we had, and we talked about how tough it was going to be. 1-2, London and Saginaw. They both finished with 50 wins. I mean, good gracious. Like what a season it was for those hockey clubs. But the other thing that I noticed you said, because I actually went back and listened, you said Owen Sound would be adding at the deadline. Now, that's when we both thought they were going to be higher up in the standings, but nonetheless, they still did make bold moves at the deadline. So it was kind of fun. If you want to go back and listen to our late September podcast, just for poops and giggles, go right ahead. So now that we, of course, stuck our necks out for that, we have to stick them out again for the playoffs. And we'll start in the Eastern Conference, Dan. The 1-8 matchup is the white hot Oshawa Generals, winners of 12 in a row, going in against Barrie. By the way, I should add that in talking about the Eastern Conference predictions at the beginning of the season, for a time I had Barrie as my top team. So they finished eighth, in case you didn't get that. Oshawa's the 1 seed, Barrie is the 8 seed. Who are you picking in that one, Dan?
Well, I think this one is one of the easier series to predict. No offense, Barry. I think Oshawa is going to roll through this one just because they built themselves for the playoffs. They're rolling at the right time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Barry did show me something down the stretch, though. They have a couple of players that really stepped up. I mean, I talked about Riley Patterson. I thought they got a lot of grit out of some of the mid guys in their lineup as well down the stretch. I've got Oshawa, though. I think I'm going to give Barry a game here. I've got Oshawa on 5. Not sure where
Very
you go.
similar. Yeah. So I was wondering the same thing. Do you give Barrie a game? I don't mind the way they were playing down the stretch, just like you, some things you could point at and give you reason for optimism of maybe getting that game. And then the other piece is after you spend so much time with your foot on the gas going for that conference title, because that's what, like, Oshawa needed to win 12 games in a row to win the conference by 2 points. Like, wow. So I wondered, does it keep going? But I'm saying yes. It's going to be 16 straight wins for the Oshawa Generals by the time the first round is done. It's going to be a sweep for the Jennies. The 2-7 matchup, North Bay in the 2 slot, Kingston is 7th. Who do you like there?
Well, it's not going to go out on a huge limb here because I do like North Bay to take this one, but I think this one's going to be a heck of a lot closer than 2 versus 7 would normally indicate because there's not that many points separating in the standings. I love what Kingston did. I think home ice is going to be a big factor here. I've got it going 7, though. I've got North Bay in 7.
Wow. Okay. I don't have as much faith in Kingston, particularly the goaltending. Sorry, guys, as you do, Dan. I love the way North Bay is built. They only got better since the deadline. I like them from the net out, and there's some unfinished business. I've got North Bay in 5 in this matchup. So that moves us to the 3-6, which I believe, well, no, actually the 4-5 is probably the most intriguing, but boy, Brantford, Ottawa. Not a bad matchup at all. Brantford, the 3 seed, Ottawa, the 6. Who do you like?
This was actually the toughest one I had, Mike, in the entire league because I like a lot about both teams. I was kind of leaning Brantford. I'm a little concerned about the health, though. Like I think Tomáš Hamara makes a big difference for them on the back end. He's unlikely to play in the first round. We know they've got Nick Lardis healthy, but how healthy? There's a few concerns around the health of the Brantford Bulldogs and the Ottawa 67s. You bet against them at your own peril. But I've been a believer. You and I have both been believers in everything Brantford's done this year. I felt all along they're built for the playoffs. They were a dark horse for us. They've got a lot of depth up and down that lineup. Physical heavy team. I've got Brantford in 7.
That's very interesting. And for every reason you said, especially you bet against Ottawa at your own peril, right? And yeah, a little bit of a banged up Brantford team. I did the exact same thing you did. Brantford in 7. And I'm thinking that city, which has embraced this team and reporting just this week too, that makes it even more likely, right? Michael Landlauer saying, you give us the arena, like the city wants to, We're staying here. The Bulldogs are staying in Brantford. It's been a great story within the context of the season's story. So 7 games, game seven, they've earned the right for home ice. Imagine that Civic Center for game seven versus Ottawa. So I've also got the Bulldogs in seven. Should be a great series, though. And, you know, I think the 4-5 is going to be a hell of a series, too. You've got the Mississauga Steelheads, who may have arrived a year early in the four seed, and Sudbury has tumbled down to fifth. The team, Dan, I'll remind you that we both picked to win the East this year, finishes on the road to start the playoffs. Who do you like?
Well, I'm sorry, Nickel City. I had you finishing first in the conference, and but I love the Mississauga Steelheads. And on paper, this should have probably to start the year been a bit of a mismatch. I'm going Steelheads in six, Mike. I love them. I love their goaltending. I love how they defend. I love how their 200-foot game, the responsibility they play with. Sudbury has been a bit of a mess for me, Mike. They can't keep the puck out of their net when they need to sometimes. Yeah, they play a tough style, which could work in the playoffs, probably should work in the playoffs. They probably should win this series. But all my instincts and gut is telling me Mississauga in six.
Can. They can't keep the puck out of the net, but they've got Drake Barahowski now as a defensive specialist hired for the Sudbury Wolves. Come on. And just imagine being the guy that was behind the bench in Sudbury, and then Barahowski comes in and you get punted up to the press box to bird dog from there. A very curious move, but obviously Sudbury identified that it was having a little bit of trouble in that regard. Look, if you don't know this about me yet, you'll fully understand it now. I am as stubborn as the day is long. I picked the Sudbury Wolves to win the Eastern Conference. Damn it. There's no way they're going out in the first round, right? For every reason you said, and then some. Like, I really like this Mississauga team. You've got a team that has trouble keeping it out of its own net in Sudbury, going up against a team that's probably got the best goaltending tandem in the entire league in Lienders and Ivan Kovic, right? Still, Sudbury got its offense going. Last weekend of the season, they were piling in the goals, and I'm stubborn. I'm taking the Wolves in six. If you want to call it an upset, the 5-over-4, then there's my upset special in the Eastern Conference. The Wolves may not win at all with that defense, but they won't go out in the first round, says I. Sorry, Mississauga. Love your team. Okay, let's move over to the Western Conference, the 1-8, the London Knights, ho-hum, your Hamilton Spectator Trophy winning first place club in the Ontario Hockey League, take on the 8th-seeded Flint Firebirds in the West. Who do you got?
You know, I feel bad doing this because I like a lot of what's going on in Flint. I like a lot of things they can do. I love what Oliver Pierre brought to the team. I love some of the grit they play with, but I've got London in four. I just the Hunter factor, the fact that they could roll off near like 23 wins. They're structured. They don't give you space. They annoy the heck out of you over a series. They make the adjustments necessary. A balanced team, a winning team. They know how to do it. This is my sweep, Mike. I got London in four.
There's no sense betting against the London Knights. It takes me back to our preseason predictions, too, when we were talking about Saginaw, London, London, Saginaw going toe to toe for the conference title, which they ended up doing. But we talked then about London, the way they play, how they're always there. I think, though, this is going to be tougher than that. Of course, I believe the Knights are going to win, but I've got London in six. I like the game that Flint plays. They've got some pieces, they got some jam. They might make it a little more difficult. I could be wrong on that, but I'm taking London in six, which brings us to Saginaw, the Memorial Cup hosts, finishing second, taking on the Owen Sound Attack, the 7th seed. What do you got there?
Well, this one confused me too, Mike, because on paper, I still in my head feel like Owen Sound should give everyone a hard time and potentially pull off an upset. Just the team I saw so much down the stretch just was lacking lifeless life. They were lacking drive. They were lacking passion and compete at times. So I don't know what's going on there, Mike, but that Saginaw team's loaded for bear. I still think Owen Sound's good enough that they're going to pull a win off, but I'm giving it to Saginaw in five.
So, for all the reasons you said, and we've been talking about them all year, the Owen Sound Attack, and how we just can't quite put our finger on why they're not performing to the potential we thought they would at the beginning of the season. But something's just off, Dan. I don't know what it is. I'm not there, but that's why I'm taking Saginaw in a sweep. I think the Owen Sound Attack will go quietly into this night after round number one, and then they'll have to figure some stuff out in the offseason there in the Scenic City. Okay, the 3-6 matchup is the Sioux Greyhounds taking on the Guelph Storm. Who do you got there?
I think this is going to be a war. I think Guelph started to play with some pretty good structure down the last 7, 8 games. I think they've got some firepower. They've got some compete. They're better than their standings finish, I think. But Sue is Sue. Sue comes at you in waves. They can skate. They're just so good. So anyway, I expect this might be the most entertaining series, Mike. But I've got Sue in six.
Great analysis of the Guelph Storm, which was a team we were both unsure of. You thought they'd be a little stronger at the beginning of the season. I was less convinced, especially in goal. I'm not sure where they're at in that department, Gillespie, Slavik, etc. But to your point about how they finished the season, I remember, oh, midway, there were some questions about Chad Wiseman and people were asking. I'm like, listen, if there were questions out there and I wasn't really listening to them then, but I think he has demonstrated that he's got a firm handle on this team and this league. He's got them playing some really good hockey. Remember how long they went without having Bushinger and Allen on the ice together through the season. So I'll bet you the Guelph Storm were licking their chops at the potential of playing the Kitchener Rangers in round number one. They draw the Sioux, who, as you talked about, it's just a bit of a wagon up north there, and they come at you in a bunch of different ways. I also have Sioux in six in this one, and it's not going to be an easy series. You know what? It could be 4-1 goal games, and it'll be over. But Guelph is going to play the Hounds tough. There's no question about it. Okay, that leaves us with the 4-5 matchup. The Kitchener Rangers finish fourth, well ahead of where we predicted they would finish, and they draw the Erie Otters, who sure finished the regular season strong, 5 in a row. I believe points in 10 of 11 games, I think is the way it worked out. Anyway, great finish to the season for the Erie Otters, who finished fifth.
If you're looking for an upset, which you usually do in the first round, you look for the team that might be ripe for the picking. I have to say that might be Kitchener. They're banged up. Mitchell Martin's a great playoff performer. His status very uncertain, probably not going to play. They're banged up. They're missing Trent Swick, another key big playoff body, is going to miss the first 3 games. You got a couple other guys banged up in that lineup at varying states of health. On the Erie side, we don't know the status of Ben Gaudreau and net. There's a few question marks, I think, about Erie's back end if the other team attacks consistently. Anyway, I'm rambling, but I think this is one that gives me a lot of pause. But I think when push comes to shove, I think there's a few more players in that Kitchener lineup that are going to step up, are going to need to step up, and I think this one's going seven, but I've got Kitchener.
So I remember saying back when the Erie Otters were sitting in the spot in the standings where I thought they were going to finish, which was seventh, saying that if there was a team 5 through 8 in the West that I would be afraid of playing in the first round, it would be the Erie Otters. And this is when 1, 2, 3, and 4 were head and shoulders above 5, 6, 7, 8 in the West. But the Erie Otters, there's just something about their structure. Stan Butler's got them buying in. You know he's a defense first guy. And then you put a goaltender like Benjamin Gaudreau behind them, and you never know, right? Gaudreau could steal a series on his own. I'm hearing that he will be back to play game one and be there for the Erie Otters. So I offer this prediction with that same caveat. I had said earlier that if any team is going to pull off a first round upset, it's going to be the Erie Otters. Something else I said earlier in the season when I was being asked question after question about the Kitchener Rangers, what's going on with this team? Are they going to, when they lose back-to-back games, is this the time they're going to lose three? And I kept saying to people, when someone shows you who they are, believe them. And the Kitchener Rangers, certainly in the first half of the season, showed us how good they can be. And for a portion of that, even without Mitchell Martin. I think that same Ranger team will be here again for the playoffs, but I'm with you, Dan. This one has got potential for either team written all over it. I'm going to go with a repeat of what happened the last time these teams met back in 2005. You believe that? It's been since 2005 since Erie and Kitchener has played in the playoffs. Rangers won that one in six. I'm taking the Rangers in six in this one as well.
That should have some intrigue in that series as well. And I know that when you're the Kitchener Rangers, you know that their top offensive players struggled a bit down the stretch, I think. And so I think the game plan against them is be physical on their top forwards. And Erie's going to bring that physicality. They got a lot of big hitters in that team. So I think the game plan's clear. It's just a question of how is Kitchener able to respond. But that one I expect to be tight.
It's going to be a lot of fun. There's a few really good matchups. That one, I think Sue Guelph is at least going to be interesting. Mississauga Sudbury, there's so much anticipation in the Nickel City this year. Could you imagine? And maybe they feel the weight of half a century's worth of expectations in Sudbury, too. That's a tough one. And Brantford, Ottawa, I think is going to be a beauty of a series. So upsets are rare. We know that. It's almost 90% of the time the top seeds advance in the Ontario Hockey League through the first round. So it won't be easy for any of the quote unquote underdogs. But I think that the regular season showed us, Dan, this year we may have had more parity than we've ever had, certainly in the past 20 years in this league, for sure.
Yeah, and when you talk about that upset stat, Mike, like in a typical year, it's because there's a pretty big gulf from first to eighth in these conferences with rebuilding teams and going for it teams. However, I feel a little weird not picking an upset in the Eastern Conference this year, because if there was ever a year where it was ripe for a first round upset, it's a year when they're all bunched within 5 or 6 points. So not terribly confident in some of those picks, Mike, but I can guarantee those series are not going to be easy in that Eastern Conference.
Well, they're on the record now. And again, you can make fun of us anytime. OHL podcast at rogers.com. One more piece of business, and that is our prospect of the week. Next week is when we shift over. Now that the playoffs are going to be underway, we'll shift over to our performer of the week and give the prospects a rest. But our final regular season draft eligible this June prospect of the week for you, Dan Maher.
Yeah, so my prospect of the week is not so much necessarily for what he did in the past couple of days, but for consistency through the season, a guy that flew under the radar. And that's on one of the teams I kind of flagged as making a push in the playoffs. And that is Jacob Battaglia on Kingston, Mike. I just, for me, he flew completely under the radar all year. You've got a fairly decent sized winger who put up nearly a point a game, 65 points this year, quietly, right? Just completely quietly. He ex beat out a number of other offensive prospects in the draft without much fanfare. Yet every time you watch Kingston, there he is, right? There he is involved in the play. There he is putting up goals, assists, getting himself on the score sheet, net front presence. So I just think it's a guy who quietly did his job all year. And anytime you're a 17-year-old player who can put up a point a game in this league, scouts take note. So my final prospect week, Jacob Battaglia.
It's interesting because I was taking a pretty close look at him too, but I wanted to see a little bit more when the games had so much meaning down the stretch. And so I shifted my attention somewhere else and going in a slightly different direction. You've actually identified this guy before. He was overlooked in his draft year, but Anthony Romanie is going to make somebody very happy this June. And again, you want to talk consistency. You want to talk about showing up when it's time to show up, when the games matter the most. Well, Anthony Romanie did that. And I understand what you're saying. Well, it's his 19-year-old season. He should be doing that. Fair enough. But 9 goals, 3 assists in his past 6 games to finish the season, 5 goals in his last 2 games, and the 58 goals he scored is more than any of the players who got drafted last year and are also in their 19-year-old years, right? Carson Rakoff, Luca Pinelli, and just count down the list from there. So for me, Anthony Romanie is the guy that gets a nod as my prospect of the week for the final time.
Yeah, great. Really stepped up his game after getting passed over last year, and still a 2005 birth, right? So you talk about some of these guys like Luke Misa, for example, his late birthday of 2005 as a player that born in the same year, but this is his first draft eligible year. So I wouldn't hold it against a kid just because he got passed over in one draft year. Because if you ask a kid to step up after getting passed over, you can't do it any better than Anthony Romanie did.
It's been a great regular season. We're going to have a ton of fun in the playoffs, and we'll see how those predictions hold up.
Well, I know mine don't usually hold up, so don't go betting based on my calls. That's all I'm saying.
I have to remember this. I went 8-0 in the first round last year. The likelihood of that happening this time, there are so many pitfalls. Like, there's a whole bunch of quicksand out there to fall into. We'll just see how it goes.
I expect I'll find it first, so.
All right, that guy over there is Dan Mahar. Find him on Twitter at Dan Mahar. My name is Mike Farwell on Twitter at Farwell underscore OHL. Really appreciate you having been along with us through this regular season. We're not done. We're staying with you right through the playoffs because this is even more fun as far as we're concerned. Send an email anytime, OHLpodcast@rogers.com. But Yeah, I just ran into somebody in Erie this past weekend who thanked us for the podcast, said they love listening to it. So we always love getting that feedback. We know you're listening and out there and enjoying this league with us. Think it's fantastic. So we'll keep it going. Tell a friend, like, subscribe, all of those things. Don't forget the YouTube channel if you're not watching it right now on YouTube, the OHL podcast, and we'll keep bringing you the content.
The Podcast Super Friends is a monthly meeting of five podcast producers.
Hi, I'm Catherine O'Brien from Branch Out Programs in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
I'm John Gay from Jag and Detroit Podcasts.
I'm Matt Kundle from the Sound Off Podcast Network.
I'm David Yes from Pod 617, the Boston Podcast Network.
And I'm Johnny Peterson from Straight Up Podcasts.
Together, they form the Podcast Super Friends, an alliance of podcast masterminds sharing best practices, insights, and discussions to help make you a better podcaster. Follow or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or at soundoff.network.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.